I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The parents of Terry Schiavo are hoping a court ruling in their favor today will save the life of their brain-damaged daughter, who's now in her 13th day without a feeding tube. Early this morning, the same Atlanta Federal Appeals Court that has twice rejected their case agreed to allow Schiavo's parents, Bob and Mary Schindler, to file another appeal days past a court deadline. Well, joining us on the line from Washington, as he has so often in this case, is George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. And Jonathan, what's going on? Many people thought the legal avenues were exhausted. So what does this new ruling mean?
Well, there may be less than meets the eye in this ruling. What the court is really doing is saying that it will allow them to file a petition because they would be barred otherwise under the court rules. I think the Court of Appeals is trying to demonstrate that it understands that this is a case of great importance to many citizens. It understands that there is a life in the balance here, and that it will waive procedural rules to allow them to make one more petition. But people should not misunderstand that. It's not a suggestion that this petition has any more merit than the previous arguments raised to this very same court.
Are they just being nice?
Well, to some extent, they may be being nice in this, in that they really could refuse to hear the petition. But what they're trying to demonstrate, I think, is that they will continue to hear any arguments that can be raised. They're not going to cut off arguments so that people don't feel that the doors of the court have been shut just in the final hours of the case.
Despite the fact that there was a deadline.
That's right. And, you know, courts, I think, do want to, for the purpose of judicial integrity, demonstrate to the public that it will keep its doors open. You know, these judges know that there are a great number of Americans on both sides of this issue. Many are deeply aggrieved by the failure to reinstate the feeding tube. And at a minimum, I think they're trying to convey to those people that they're not going to foreclose arguments, but they should not take this as any great hope that this court will reverse a decision that, after all, was made by a vote of 10 to 2.
Do you think, Jonathan, that there are any politics here? Because the appeals courts are supposed to be immune to that.
Well, the court is. It's just judges aren't. You know, judges are human beings. They live in neighborhoods. They have neighbors. They read papers and they watch TV. These judges know that this case has galvanized the nation. And I think it's not uncommon to see courts respond to that.
Well, and of course, the Schindlers don't see this as just a nice gesture. They feel that they have a new argument that's been researched since this past weekend. What's that argument?
Well, they only speak of it generally in this filing, that they have new research to indicate that the court failed to consider the factual basis of its previous order, that it in fact ruled purely on procedural grounds when it should have reached the facts or merits of the case. That is a variation of a previous argument made to this court, but they are putting forth some new cases and some newly worked arguments to see if they could secure an order. But it's very unlikely that the Court of Appeals would issue an injunction, an order to reinstate the feeding tube pending consideration of those types of arguments. They will need essentially to show this court a slam dunk legal case today in order for such an order to be issued.
And your sense of whether that's going to happen?
I think it's very unlikely, and I know that's very, very painful, but, you know, Court of Appeals often can get these last-minute filings, particularly in death row cases. They often do hear them, and they often turn them down.
And Jonathan, just as an observer of the law, I'm going to conflate it with politics once again. What do you see on the horizon happening as a result of this case? Do you see law being made? Do you see law being changed? Do you see movement towards something that you're watching in a broader sense as we're watching the case unfold this week?
I think that we very well could see some changes. One of the questions that, frankly, I'm concerned about is whether Michael Schiavo is the proper guardian after he has created a new relationship with a third party and has two children by that person.
But Jonathan, I just have to ask you, because as we've been told over and over again, it's not about whether or not he's even married to her. It's about that he claims he heard her say what her wishes were.
Well, I think that's right, although much of this case turns on the fact that Michael Schiavo is effectively her guardian. I think that when this is all over, we do need to look at under what circumstances guardianship should be transferred to the next of kin in priority.
Jonathan Turley, professor of law at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Jonathan, thank you as always.
Thank you.
It's that time of year. College acceptance letters are being sent out across the country. And today we're going to look at several aspects of higher education. What questions do you ask when picking a school? How do you pay for tuitions soaring up to $40,000 a year? But we begin with Laura Couturier. She's with the Futures Project at Brown University, and that was founded to study how market forces drive higher education. Laura, welcome.
Thank you.
And we should say right at the start, we here and now are on the campus of Boston University. In fact, BU owns the license of the radio station we broadcast from. Right across the street is one of the shiniest sports facilities I've ever seen. It's got three pools, including one where you can swim against a current. It's got a climbing wall. And behind that, the high-rise dorm that's said to have some of the best real estate in Boston. Beautiful view of the city. Students get their own rooms, cooking facilities for every three or four rooms. I'm understanding that this is part of a trend across the country?
That's right. It's such an interesting trend. It's something we're seeing at all types of colleges and universities. Often when people hear about these types of beautiful new amenities, they assume that this is something that's limited to the most expensive schools or the elite schools. But what is really disturbing is that we're seeing this same type of competition happen at all types of institutions, and at institutions that might have a student body who can't afford to support these amenities.
Well, I was going to say, why is it disturbing to you?
Because we are seeing institutions competing over the wrong things. More colleges and universities are buying into this competition where they're trying to attract students using top-notch athletic facilities, using beautiful cafeterias, using financial aid as a way to lure students to campus instead of as a way to expand opportunity for disadvantaged students. And so what we're seeing is this heightened level of competition that is pulling institutions further and further away from their public missions to educate a broader share of our population.
Well, but don't universities and colleges have to compete with market forces? I mean, if a student sees school A and it has a climbing wall and school B doesn't and they're interested in climbing, that's how they're going to make their decision. So schools have to compete.
Well, and that's one of the more insidious things about this trend is that when you look at each and every decision that's made, they all make perfect sense. And so the incentives are all wrong, and the pressures are very real for college leaders to make these choices. The pressure to have beautiful dorms and to have athletic facilities are coming not just from students, but from parents, from trustees, from legislators, from governors.
From rankings? I'm being only a little bit facetious, but schools are now ranked by, for instance, U.S. News and World Report. Is that a part of it?
That's a huge part of it, and that's a part of also what feeds into this this activity where colleges and universities are trying to attract a certain type of student to their campus. They're typically trying to attract students who bring high GPAs and high test scores and thereby improve their rankings in things like U.S. News and World Report. And so they're using financial aid as a way to entice a student instead of as a way to address real financial need for some students.
Well, how do you think that colleges and universities should both entice students and measure and thus proclaim their success?
What we need to do is encourage colleges and universities to compete over the things that really matter. If we could instead encourage our colleges and universities to measure their performance and to demonstrate what kind of value added they're providing in the learning experience and to make that information publicly available, and if we could encourage our colleges and universities to compete over which ones graduate a higher proportion of low-income students, and, you know, the things that really matter that will improve our society instead of competing over who has the nicest gym. We're seeing more of an emphasis on graduation rates, which I think is a good thing. We are unfortunately not graduating a high enough proportion of our students across the nation, and especially when we're talking about students who have been historically underserved by our higher education system, we are not graduating enough of them. And when we're talking about tuition levels that are growing to such a high rate, we're talking about a real problem here, because if we continue to focus on access to higher education using loans instead of grants for students, but then we don't ensure that they graduate. The question then is, what are we providing them access to? We're providing them access to debt without the credential that helps them have a better life opportunity.
Well, I want to turn our attention for a second to public higher education. Last month, both chambers of the General Assembly in Virginia passed what was described as milestone legislation regarding the state's publicly funded colleges and universities. In effect, giving these schools more autonomy, which they had asked for. Explain more about what happened in Virginia and how that's reflected across the country.
Virginia is just the latest in a number of legislative changes that have happened in other states as well, where the public colleges and universities are looking to essentially renegotiate the way that they are structured within the state. And they're looking for more autonomy in specific areas that can be very bureaucratic, such as purchasing, building, hiring and firing. And then the big thing, though, that almost everyone wants is authority over setting tuition.
Well, now, why would they want this change? And by the way, in exchange for this autonomy, we understand they're going to get less funding from the state, so they would probably need higher tuitions, right?
That's right. They're agreeing to a cap on state funding, and in return, they're looking to be able to set their own tuition rates and also have more freedom to, for example, negotiate a contract with a local corporation. And so that's how they're planning to make up any state appropriations that are foregone if they do cap the state appropriation.
So it's a move towards privatizing, at least in part, public education. What do you see as the danger in that?
Our public colleges and universities provide access to higher education. They provide a high-quality education for state's residents. They participate in economic development. They do outreach with local high schools. And those public missions are absolutely critical to the way that our states function. And if we allow ourselves to water down that relationship and to let the institutions move further and further away from being considered state institutions, we really risk losing those essential functions and those essential contributions of our colleges and universities.
Laura Couturier is with the Futures Project at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And just ahead, we'll continue our conversation about higher education. Outside of nice new buildings, just how do you measure a good education? And later in the program, we'll look at how some college students are abusing prescription drugs in an attempt to enhance their academic performance. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been speaking about how market forces force colleges and universities to attract students with all sorts of things, from financial aid for students who don't need it to climbing walls. But once the students are in school, how do you measure that experience? And what questions should parents and students ask to get beyond the climbing walls? John Hayek is with the National Survey of Student Engagement, which is based in Bloomington, Indiana. The firm is hired by colleges and universities to measure how engaged students are while in school. And John, first of all, what do you mean by engaged?
Well, what we mean by engaged is that we want students to be involved in their educational process. And we look at engagement really in two parts. It's what students actually do during their college experience. It's the quality of effort that they put forth. It's the time that they spend studying. But it's also what the institutions do to enhance students, to induce students to do these right things.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about some of the questions that you ask. But what are the, you know, the categories that you're looking at?
We look at a number of different areas. We look at how involved students are in both academic and social experiences, and this is both formal and informal, inside the classroom and outside the classroom. We take a look at areas such as how students are using technology, how they're exposed to diversity, how much reading and writing they're doing, the quality of relationships that exist on campus between students and faculty, between students and administrators. Mm-hmm. We take a look at areas such as how involved they are in their community, how supportive the campus is in terms of the learning environment, advising, satisfaction, things
right.
along that.
A huge range. And let's start with some of the academic areas. I'm holding a questionnaire, and one of the questions is, about how many hours do you spend in a typical 7-day week doing each of the following? A would be preparing for class. That means studying, reading, writing, doing homework or lab work, analyzing, rehearsing, and other academic activities. And then down at E, there's relaxing and socializing, watching TV, partying, etc. There's also places where you ask about how students might, you know, interact with professors. A question asks, how often have you done each of the following? Made a class presentation, come to class without completing readings, used email to communicate with an instructor. What can you find out about what kids do academically while in school?
Well, as a parent and as a prospective student, you need to ask questions. You need to ask good questions and that are related to the learning experience, and that's what our survey does. And actually, we have a college guide, a campus guide that's available on our website that helps students, leads students and parents through these types of questions. For instance, you know, students need to be asking on a campus tour what faculty expect of students in terms of the academic performance. How much do students study? How much reading and writing is required? How often are things learned in the class discussed outside of the classroom? How is the quality of advising there? How is diversity incorporated into the curriculum? They need to be asking questions like this.
I'm looking at some of the other questions, and I'm wondering, would you suggest, for instance, that a parent should ask students on a college tour, how often have you worked harder than you thought you could to meet an instructor's standards or expectations? In other words, are you raising the bar here? Are you working harder than you thought you could? Is that something that a parent should ask while on a tour?
Most definitely. One of the things our research indicates is that high expectations, you know, from the institution, high expectations that are placed upon students are a strong indicator of student success and student learning. So students should go into an environment where faculty and administrators at the institution expect a lot out of them.
And we understand that you have a private relationship with the schools that you do these ratings for, so you don't release a list of colleges and universities and rate them.
Exactly. We don't have a publicly available list, but what's important to realize is that students and parents can ask the institutions that they're visiting about our survey and about the results. An analogy might be you wouldn't buy a $25,000 car without knowing the specifics of its safety, of its gas mileage. And this is the same thing related to student learning. You need to ask institutions about what type of evidence, what type of data that they can provide to you that these important things are actually taking place.
And when you ask, how did you do on the survey, what kind of answers might you get? Is it a number? Is it a rating? How do they know how well a school did?
Sure. Well, there are reports that we send out to all schools that will give them the percentages of how students respond on every question. And there's also comparative data that they have, so they not only know how their own students are answering the questions in terms of, you know, the percentage of students that answer very often or often, but they also have comparative data among similar types of schools. And so this is really, it's a great institutional improvement tool for institutions that want to get better.
And it's great for parents to see because you can see how often students write papers or how often they have a spiritual activity if that's important to you.
Exactly.
By the way, we talked to a researcher earlier who said that she wished that colleges and universities made a bigger deal about the success rate of graduating low-income or low-achieving students. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. You know, some of our research has really pointed to the institutions that are able to focus on these, what we might call low-engaged students, really benefit a lot. If you focus on these students that are less engaged, you can actually raise the bar for the entire institution.
And lastly, we've been having some fun talking about Boston University. We're on their campus, and they have, you know, a climbing wall, for instance. But in combination with great academics, that can be something that can boost a student's engagement.
Most definitely. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the average student only is in class about 15 or 17 hours during the week. All the rest of the time is really what makes the difference. How they interact with other students, how they engage in extracurricular activities, how much time they spend with faculty, and how much time they talk among their peers. All those other things outside of class is really what makes the difference in terms of the learning experience.
John Hayek is with the National Survey of Student Engagement. John, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And for more on the National Survey on Student Engagement or the Futures Project, go to our website, here-now.org. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a top military official in Israel says Palestinian forces are thwarting many terrorist attacks inside Israel. We'll have a report. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been looking today at issues on college campuses. While the use of drugs on campus is nothing new, a growing concern is the abuse of prescription drugs by undergraduates. Officials say the highly addictive painkiller OxyContin is increasingly being abused as a recreational drug by college students. Add to that another problem that is also prevalent on college campuses, the abuse of medications prescribed for attention deficit disorders. Here and Now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff has more on the story.
Students call them academic steroids or kiddie coke. You might know them by the names Adderall and Ritalin, commonly prescribed for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or ADHD. College health professionals say these and other stimulant drugs are now widely used by college students primarily to help them stay up late and focus on studying. Dr. Richard Cattison, chief of mental health services at Harvard University, says students think the drugs will improve their academic performance.
People do get a buzz from these medications. It allows them to stay up later and feel more energized, and there's kind of a sense of well-being that comes with them. And the students use that, you know, just for those reasons.
Cattison says his counterparts at other schools say this is a pattern because students are doing whatever they can to get an edge. At Boston University's Student Union, it's easy to find students who say they've either abused ADHD drugs or know someone who has. Dan, a senior, says he gets Ritalin from a friend to help him focus.
I had two exams yesterday and took a Ritalin at like 11 before my first class to make sure I was awake because I had been up late studying, and then one after my first exam before my second exam to make sure I was still awake for my second exam. So.
And how do you feel now?
Completely normal.
Dan doesn't want to use his real name because he knows taking the drugs is illegal. But he says he doesn't believe the pills are any more dangerous than alcohol.
The drug's been clinically proven to help people with attention disorder and help them focus. And that's exactly what I needed to do, and that's exactly what it does.
There have been no national studies to quantify this problem, say health professionals. One is due out later this year from Columbia University's National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse. But canvassing students at random at Northeastern University, it's clear misusing prescription drugs is prevalent on campus. Freshman Amanda Katzman.
I know multiple people who've taken, in particular, Adderall and Ritalin to stay up and write papers and or study for long tests. And both of them said that, you know, it keeps them up through the night, even though it does make them agitated and fidgety, but they can stay up through the whole night.
For someone with ADHD, these prescription medications help them focus. But for those who don't have attention issues, they act as strong stimulants. And they can be psychosocially addictive, says Dr. Punyamutala Kishore, president of the National Library of Addictions. He says users recall their heightened focus, but don't feel any physical withdrawal symptoms. Kishore says students are turning to prescription drugs as colleges are cracking down on underage drinking on campus.
That's actually making a bump towards these other drugs, OxyContin, Ritalin type drugs, which are like little pills. They can put it in their pocket. You know, there's no smell of alcohol in the breath. Nobody's wiser if you're taking it or not.
Kishore says abuse of these drugs can cause psychosis, aggression, and paranoia, as well as seizures and an irregular heartbeat. It can also lead to other illegal drug use, as was the case with 21-year-old James, who is now a college junior and doesn't want his name used because he says it would hurt his reputation.
When I was around, I'd say, 13 years old, the doctors started to prescribe me to Ritalin and Adderall.
Later in college, James continued to take the medication, even though he no longer had a prescription. He'd get it from friends or buy it. It's part of college culture now, says James.
The kids get it, and they don't use it as they're supposed to, and it ends up going to, you know, other people, parties. People were big into sniffing it, and it's just like doing cocaine. There's really no difference between the two. The only difference is Adderall lasts a little longer. Might not be as of an intense high.
This off-label use of Ritalin and Adderall is no surprise, given the huge increase in prescriptions written for the drugs, says Mike Montaigne, professor of social pharmacy at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Montaigne says nationally, there's been a 500% increase in the number of Ritalin prescriptions and a 500 to 600% increase in Adderall. Massachusetts writes the highest number of prescriptions for Adderall.
Those students who have Ritalin prescriptions or Adderall prescriptions, it doesn't take long for most of the people on the campus to know who's got those prescriptions, and then you can enter into any kind of an exchange with that. You can sell the drug, you can barter for homework, you can do just about anything.
Pills cost between $3 and $5 on the black market, but health professionals point out that anyone can purchase the drugs online without a prescription. While most schools survey their students about alcohol use, few ask about drugs. But last year, Tufts University surveyed its students and found that 19% have misused prescription medications. Margot Abels is the director of Alcohol and Drug Prevention Services at Tufts.
I think some of the disconnect for students that worries me, I mean, the use, of course, is worrisome, and I think that's what we all focus on, but I don't think students often focus on the fact that there could be some serious legal ramifications giving somebody your prescription.
It's a felony.
It's kind of like a wolf in sheep's clothing. It looks harmless.
James, who started abusing Adderall as a teenager, moved on to marijuana, mushrooms, OxyContin, and heroin. He's now recovering, but his drug abuse led to a heart problem.
When I used to take it, you know, I'd say, you know, I have a prescription for it. You know, maybe the doctors don't know that, you know, I need extra of this medicine because I'm, you know, a special case or something. I would take it and not see it as a problem.
College health professionals fear prescription drug abuse is a problem that won't be easy to control. The pills don't smell, they're easy to hide, and thousands of college students have a legitimate need for the medications, making the drugs a reality of college life.
Our story reported by Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff. And this note, if you are not in the office pool, you may not know that sports fans around the country have been glued to their TV sets this month, watching one of the most dramatic NCAA tournaments in the history of college hoops. There were several nail biters this past weekend, with three overtime games, including a double overtime win by Michigan State over the University of Kentucky. Overtime games are not the norm for March Madness. In the last 30 years of regional finals, there have only been eight. The Final Four will be played in St. Louis on Saturday, with the University of Louisville and the University of Illinois facing off, and Michigan State taking on the University of North Carolina. Meantime, the Women's Final Four starts Sunday in Indianapolis. Tennessee and Michigan State will face off after advancing last night. Baylor University and Louisiana State University make up the other semifinal. Still to come, author Cynthia Katahara's new book for young readers just won a top award, and we'll find out why. You're listening to Here and Now.
As we mentioned earlier, high school seniors across the country are waiting to hear which colleges have accepted them. Then the hard work begins, students and their families trying to figure out how to pay for that privilege. Seamus Harries is the Dean of Student Financial Services at Northeastern University here in Boston, and he spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
How are students paying for college these days?
Overall, if you look at the College Board recent study on trends in college pricing, you'll look that 60% of students are receiving some type of financial aid. So about 40% are writing a check. Their parents are, they are, from their income or their savings and paying for college. The remaining 60% are applying for financial aid, federal, state, or institutional aid.
Let me talk about the application process, if we could, for a few minutes. Well, what are some of the most common mistakes that people, either students or students and families, make when applying for aid?
If you haven't completed your tax return, you'll fill out the form on estimated information. And we have a trend of parents that may extremely overestimate. So we're providing an aid award on an income that looks that is actually way too high. Or a family is underestimating, in which we're providing an estimated award to you based on an income that's too low. The second biggest mistake, and we hear this in a variety of areas with talking with students and parents, is students and parents look at the costs and walk away. They might get accepted to an institution, but they never end up applying for aid. And you don't know what kind of aid you're eligible for until you apply. And that's a big mistake, that families just look at the price and say, there's no way I can write a check for it. 66% of our students are receiving institutional grant aid, and 72% of them are receiving federal and state or institutional grant aid. So we encourage you to apply. Don't make the mistake of walking away before you even have a chance to look at what options are available to you.
Whether they walk away or not, I think the perception in most families is, at this moment, unless you're well off, you're going to incur a massive amount of debt whether in going to college.
Education is a value in which if you want to move into the next economic level, or you want to, your son or daughter wants to go in a particular field that really is the only opportunity you have really to move into that field. And it is, and it always has been, we've talked about education being, in particular at the college and university level, a sacrifice. It is something that families need to sit down, have a conversation about, understand and plan for, not just that first year, not just that first semester, but that whole 4 years to graduation. How are you going to pay for this? Your aid counselor typically is there to assist you. It is a decision which many families will have to take on some debt because either they haven't planned or they're unable to provide the funding for the full cost of college.
Finally, Dean Harries, let me ask you, is there some way that we can, our parents and students, can maximize the amount of financial aid they receive? I mean, certainly they need to be honest in the forms they fill out, but is there some way that they can be sure that at least they're maximizing their chances to get as much as they can?
It's very difficult to say. You have to be straightforward on what you have in the forms. There are various things that the forms take into consideration, making sure that the student income is appropriate, making sure that if you are self-employed and you earn a lot last year from commissions, but you're not likely to earn a lot this next year, making sure that you have a conversation with a financial aid counselor about your actual financial circumstances. Many times the data elements that are supplied on the FAFSA form don't accurately reflect what is going on actually right now, a change in income, a bonus you received last year or not this year. Make sure that you have that conversation with a financial aid counselor about what's really going on, not just last year's tax return, because things may have changed.
So then maybe the strategy is don't just fill out the form, make the phone call or make the appointment and actually see or at least talk to a counselor.
We very much encourage that at Northeastern, and I know that many institutions do. They are your resource. If you're not understanding what loan options are out there or what the best loan is for you, or is there other aid available, grant aid available, scholarship aid available, they're your best contact. Keep in contact with them. Not just the freshman year or as you're making the decision to go to an institution, but throughout your 4 years there, and talking about to them as you go into repayment for your loans. They have all the information, or at least can point you in the right direction to make sure you have all the information.
Dean Seamus Harries, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And everyone else is taking notes. Seamus Harries is the Dean of Student Financial Services at Northeastern University in Boston. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Author Cynthia Cotahata's new book, Kira Kira, tells the story of life in the deep south of Georgia in the 1950s through the eyes of a six-year-old Japanese-American named Katie. Here, her eight-year-old sister Lynn counsels Katie before her first day of school.
Have you noticed that sometimes people won't say hello to Mom when we're out shopping?
Uh-huh.
Well, some of the kids at school may not say hello to you either.
You mean because they don't know me?
No, I mean because they don't want to know you.
Why wouldn't they want to know me?
Who wouldn't want to know me? This was a new idea for me. Our father had always thought we were quite amazing, and Lynn, of course, had thought I was perfect. So I thought of myself as rather amazing, and maybe even perfect. Then Lynn continued, because there's only 31 Japanese people in the whole town, and there's more than 4,000 people in the town, and 4,000 divided by 31 is a lot more of them than us. Do you understand?
No.
A reading from Cynthia Cotahata's new book, Kira Kira, which recently won the Newbery Medal, which is given for the most distinguished contribution to children's literature. Cotahata's first novel, The Floating World, also was about the Japanese-American experience. And author Cynthia Cotahata joins us now on the line from Long Beach, California, to talk about Kira Kira. Welcome.
Thanks. It's very nice to be here.
Well, Kira Kira, what does that mean?
It means glittering in Japanese, in the way that a star would glitter.
The book centers around a Japanese family in Georgia in the 50s. It's about so many things. It centers on a relationship between two sisters, so it's about gender. It's about class. They're poor. And it's also about racism. Early on, there's a scene where the family is moving and they have to check into a motel. Could you just describe that scene for us and what's happening there? Because it's astonishing to remember. This is in the 50s in America.
Yes, they're trying to check into a hotel, and they're charged more because they're Japanese. And actually, where that came from was, it was a little bit earlier. It was from experiences with my dad when he was actually in uniform as a member of the Army, and there were people who would not serve him because he was Japanese. And sometimes they would say they wouldn't serve him. He had very dark skin, and they would say they wouldn't serve him because he was Mexican. And then he would say, well, I'm not Mexican, I'm Japanese. And they said, well, then we won't serve you because you're Japanese. And even in the 50s, he said when he was driving around looking for work, when he would walk into a restaurant, you could hear a pin drop.
Really? Yeah, well, as a Japanese-American, your father was interned by the U.S. government during World War II.
Yes, he was.
This family that we're learning about in Kira Kira is traveling across America shortly after World War II. What else of your father's experience did you put in their story?
Basically, that he was a chicken sexer, and he worked very, very long hours at a very, very hard, difficult job.
I think we need to understand what a chicken sexer is.
Right. It's in order to save money on food, because the people raising the chickens don't want to feed the males because they're, because they can't lay eggs, basically. And so what they do is the second the chickens are born, they are given to the chicken sexers, and the sexers separate them into males and females. And then the males are actually taken outside almost immediately and drowned.
All right. Well, so is this something that the little girl sees in the book?
Yes, she does.
Yeah. So this little girl, Katie, is seeing some pretty, tough stuff from her little vantage point. What other kinds of experiences that were uniquely Japanese-American did you put in this character?
I think the biggest thing is maybe just the sense of being an outsider and maybe having a stronger sense of needing to have safety within your family because they were like you. And the other thing that there are certain things that were true in the novel. And one is that everybody in the hospital did come to see my brother when he was born because they had never seen a Japanese baby before. I mean, the entire staff of the hospital wanted to look at him.
And, how long ago was that?
That was 1960.
And other experiences?
I did have a very heavy southern accent when I was a little girl, and I think people thought that was weird because they just thought it seemed incongruous that someone who looked like me should talk so heavily southern.
Yeah. I mentioned that it's also a story about girls, And there's a lot about girls trying to be friends and trying to be with the most popular girls. At one point, Katie has her hair curled, and it didn't work out all that well. Did you have that experience as a young Japanese-American?
Yeah, we somewhat did. My sister, I think it was worse for her than for me. She was only a year and a half older, but she had a deeper awareness of feeling like a second-class citizen, which I didn't feel as profoundly just because I had her to tell me otherwise. But we definitely did have, we have many pictures of ourselves with the rather ridiculously curled hair.
Wait, but is this something, I mean, I'm wondering if a lot of young girls now are going to relate to this because at least in the major cities, I can't speak for the whole country, but at least in the major cities here in, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, for instance, you would never think of an Asian as the other or even as a minority
right,
in many
right.
ways.
Right. I have had some mail from kids, both with my first novel and with this one, about being an outsider. So I think they still relate, whether it's because you're Asian or whatever, they relate to that sense of being an outsider.
Hmm. Well, I just want to talk about your career as an author for just one second, because we almost didn't have Kira Kira. Your first book, The Floating World, terrific rave reviews. And then, you know, a dry period, shall we say. And you ended up, a secretary in a food processing plant for a while. What's that like to be thinking, well, that was great, but it's over?
I think it's exhausting because it's so exhausting to try to get published in the first place. And then to reach that point where you are published and you feel you're doing well, and then to lose that and to think you have to do it all over again.
Hmm. And as we said, a friend, luckily,
yeah.
talked you into considering young fiction. You had to be talked into it.
Yes, because I didn't really... I hadn't read a lot of children's fiction since I was a child, and she sent me a box of books, children's novels, and then I realized that it wasn't that different from what I was doing anyway, so.
Mm. Well, and now we mentioned that your father inspired a lot of your writing. He was interned by the U.S. government during World War II, and we understand your next book, you're going to talk about that?
Yes, my next book is called Weed Flower, and it's about some Japanese-American flower farmers during World War II, and they're interned in Poston, which is where my father was interned and where he was drafted out of. And Poston was located on an Indian reservation, so it's really partly about a friendship between a young Japanese-American girl and a Mojave boy who lives on the reservation.
Mm. Many people that were interned, we understand, didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I had to do a lot of interviews with other people because my father actually doesn't like to talk about it.
How does he feel about the success that you've had writing about your experience as a Japanese American at that time?
Now he's very excited about it. At the time, when I first started writing, he would always say, "Nobody is interested in reading about Japanese."
Well, lucky for you, he's wrong.
Right.
Author Cynthia Karahata, her book Kira Kira just received the Newbery Medal for Children's Fiction. She'll pick up that medal this summer. Cynthia, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.